Hi, my name is Jordan. I am a special education teacher from the UK. I share my passion for everything communication, sensory regulation, and fun lesson ideas for my classroom of disabled pupils aged 4 to 11. Each week, I am joined by experts in the field, answering your questions and sharing our knowledge and experience working alongside our beautiful young people. Let's get started.
So these episodes are going to be a little bit different over August. We are going to relook at my favourite moments from the podcast from series one. We've had such amazing conversations this year, and thank you so much to everybody who has been on the podcast. You've been incredible, and thank you so much for all the listeners for your support so that we can continue this for series two from September. I hope you enjoy taking a look back at, my favourite moments.
Very often as adults, we really mess it up because they've got a system. They've got a thing that they want to do.
They don't need us.
And we're so desperate to be part of the play and to join in that we accidentally get in the way. And what we then do is we prove their point, which is that other people get in the way. And so, one of the best kind of tips is to just sit alongside for a while. Just sit alongside, be present, but not actively involved. And then what I tend to do as like a stepping stone into their play is I'd maybe find my own bottle top and just have one, and I'd just do the same thing as them, but separately and alongside. And so they
sometimes
do that.
I even have to have invisible things, because sometimes having something that's then not part of their set is really upsetting and dysregulating, or they want everything that I've got, and then it becomes a bit of a battle. So if you're finding that, do try that, but if you're finding that, sometimes I have invisual things and I just copy the movement or the sound or the something, because then I'm still joining in without that weird battle. And if you feel that they're uncomfortable with how close you are, then take a step back. Or if they feel that you're uncomfortable with how you're sitting, then sit somewhere else. But they're obviously aware of you, and that's good. That is the start. It's just we want them to be as comfortable as possible. And this isn't a magic wand. It takes time, and that's the point, isn't it? If you're committed to it, then gradually,
quite often when we do something new and we're trying this kind of play and interaction therapy to start with, it will feel new and maybe a little bit too much for children. And so they might watch you do your invisible bottle top, and they might take their seven over to the other side and kind of set it up. No, thank you. This was actually a me time activity. And again, that's absolutely fine. I tend to just narrate along with it and go, oh, I had a turn, but now it's time for you to play by yourself. I understand. I'll come back later. And, just narrate alongside it and almost give that like advocating phrase
allow
to
that.
Them as they go. So they move along and I go, oh, I need a bit of space. And they kind of, as if I'm talking as them, so that they can hear that phrase. They might use it another time if they can. It means that you've had this very equal interaction there. Like, I didn't come in and insist that I must be part of your play. I haven't taken over. I haven't taken your toys. I haven't touched your play.
Yeah.
I've just offered to be part of it. I've asked for an invite, and then you've either replied saying, join in, or no, thanks, not today. And I think we have to show children that both of those things are an option. Like, they can say, no, thanks for you joining in.
And
this
gradually,
play. It feels too special.
Exactly. And sometimes it is. We all like me time, don't we? And that relationship and trust will have to build, won't it? And if you're showing them, I respect your space and I allow you to advocate for yourself, and you give consent to me working with you and playing with you, and I honour when you don't give that, then next time they might be a little bit less anxious that you're going to step in, because they'll realise that this person doesn't do that in,
I think it's a huge gesture of connection to allow a child to say, I'd like to do this by myself, and for an adult to respect that. I think it can be really new for a child. They might not have ever experienced that before, because there are so many other times where as adults we have to lead them and we have to guide them and we have to show them, and we have to be in charge of whether you can eat that and whether you can climb on that. But actually in play, know, they can be fully in charge of that. And so it's really empowering for them.
In a paid environment, it is your job. You're paid to work with this child. You might be being watched by the parent. You know, it takes so much.
I'm always being watched. Right.
So it might take so much confidence to step back because you almost want something to happen, I can imagine.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, but I think it's about explaining that there's a reason for that space, yes, and that, okay, distance, and that my motivation is not to make them talk or to make them play with me. Like, that's not my aim. My aim in therapy is for us to build a connection through play, and a connection is a two-way thing. Like, I can't make them connect with me, but so often that offering of, like, this is up to you means that we do connect. Because, you know, they go off and they do their thing, and then maybe I play something different over here, and they are curious about it, and so they come over and maybe they take all of my bottle tops that I started to play with.
But all of a sudden, you've got that interest.
But we're still interacting now, and I say, oh, you need them all, okay, here they are, and we, you know, I'm then helping.
Yeah.
And then passing the bottle tops over. Are there any more in this basket? I will go and check for you. I found three more. Here you go. You know, and we're now in a collaborative play, accidentally.
Yeah.
But it started actually with me being rejected and accepting that rejection. Or in this.
Absolutely. And they're and not even equal, but they're actually in charge of this interaction, aren't they? Yes. They're fully in charge and in control. And okay. Yeah. Great.
That's
fine. Too. And then meanwhile, you're thinking in your head, right, how can I do this different next week? Or do I have all the bottle tops all over the room and we have to look for them or whatever? Like, you might be, next time you're just thinking, aren't you? Like, how can I extend this? How can I move this on a little bit? Or what could have been better? You know, all we're constantly questioning that, aren't we?
My cat has just jumped onto the desk.
We're constantly questioning that, aren't we, and kind of improving our own practice in that way. And it's it very rarely is what we plan. I love your Instagram post when you say, this is what I set up and this is what we ended up doing.
This is how we actually played,
because it's
and it has to, I think it has to, you have to be willing to be really flexible and have an idea and a plan, because that's important. You know what you're hoping for, but also be very accepting of the fact that the children that I support usually have a very clear plan for themselves, and our plans may or may not kind of cross over with each other, and that's okay. We might have to just work with where we are, and like you were saying earlier, each visit that I do or each session that I do, like, I have to look at where that child's at on that day. How, you know, where's their cup at? Where's their, you know, did they skip lunch today because it wasn't what they liked? Is it Friday or is it Monday? Did they have a school trip earlier in the week? You know, has mum been poorly and so the routine's been off because auntie's been in to help run the show? You know, children aren't robots, and so we can't plan for robots. We have to plan for tiny humans that are going to have very different feelings and very different expectations every single time you see them.
Best bit of the job, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's so boring. I think
you have to really love that kind of on the go, okay, this is where we're at, how are we gonna like weave that therapy idea into this now instead?
There's the famous five conscious senses, and actually hidden in those are a lot of the subconscious. So like, we have a sense of temperature and a tactile sense, and we cluster them all together as touch, but it's possible to be able to feel texture but not be able to understand temperature, or it's possible to be able to feel temperature and not understand texture. So it's a bit like deciding how many constellations there are in the sky. It just depends how we group these neurons. But there are 33 sets of neurons that control your senses. So arguably you've got 33 sensory systems, but that would get a bit much, because in a sensory story you only get 8 to 10 sentences. So 7 is manageable, 8, 9 is getting a bit too ambitious really. But my 7, I do the famous 5, And then quite like often you're working with somebody who is missing one of the sensory systems or can't eat, and you lose a few. So it's worth having a couple of backups. I use proprioception, which is your awareness of where your body is in space. And it's a weird one to think about, but most people have had an experience of not having proprioception just as they're waking up or falling asleep, and they get that sensation of falling. Do you ever have that?
Yes.
And what's happening is your proprioceptive sense is falling asleep slightly before you or waking up slightly after you, and you just have a moment where you don't have an awareness of where your body is in space.
Right.
It's a really unnerving thing, and people can have differences to their proprioception in the same way they can have differences to vision or differences to hearing. And so if you don't have full proprioceptive capacity, and I'm actually somebody who doesn't, you don't fully have an awareness of where your body is all the time, and that's slightly unnerving.
Yeah.
So stimulation that tells somebody where their body is a really good way of supporting the proprioceptive sense. So things like compression wear clothing and the weighted blankets and all of those things that are so popular in the sensory market, that's what they're doing. They're giving you information about where your body is. Brushing, massage, all of those things vibration is a great one, ways of offering support proprioception. And then my other one I do is your vestibular sense, which is your sense of motion and balance. So if you can incorporate a movement in your sensory story, and it has to be a movement that involves the head, because the sense receptors to your vestibular sense are in your inner ear. So it's no good just waving your hand, that wouldn't do it. But anything that creates like an up, a down, or around would offer stimulation to your vestibular sense and be another way.
Children in chairs, would you spin, rock, shake? If they can do that, I mean, is that what it looks like?
Yeah. And actually, so your senses are a part receptor organ, part your brain understanding the information from the receptor organ. So the only time we really give that any credit in kind of day-to-day life is when we give babies black and white picture books, because we recognize this is a baby that can see, but they're not seeing in the same way that I'm seeing. And what's happening is it's partly, you know, the receptor organs picking up the information and partly your brain making sense of it. And it's about 25% pick up, 75% make sense of it. And so I have a friend who is blind, but her eyes work perfectly.
Right.
But her brain can't understand it. And a lot of the people that I work with maybe have the receptor capacity, but it's taking them longer to put together this information. And so I often talk about there being a curriculum of the senses. And I have a course called Develop Your Sensory Lexiconry, which is me teaching that curriculum of the senses. But there are things that it is easier for your senses to do and things that it is harder for them to do. So like the black and white picture books for sight, that makes sense, doesn't it? You pop out, you're getting all this visual information. It's easier to figure out that's black and that's white than it is to figure out that's peach and that's lemon yellow. Like sequence of things that you're learning. And with regards to your vestibular sense, that sense of motion and balance, the early way we learn about that sense is through bold directional movement. So you think of what we do with little babies. We rock them side to side, we push them forwards and backwards in their buggy, and then we pass them to their daddy and they lob them into the air. Like it's bold directional movement. And if you're somebody who requires supportive equipment, like if you're in a funky wheelchair, you probably spent your early years maybe in a bed, maybe you were in intensive care, you won't have had as much chance to have those bold directional movements. So you won't have had the opportunity to make sense of that stimulation, and you might not be processing it fully yet. And so by giving you those opportunities to access that movement, you can give an opportunity to help somebody understand the messages coming from their senses. And then that gives you more access to the work. Those two, I'm quite often eavesdropper on conversations where people go, would you prefer to be deaf? Or would you prefer to be blind? Like there's a hierarchy. And actually, if you interjected in those conversations and said, would you prefer to be blind or would you prefer to lose your vestibular sense? Most people would go, I want my vestibular sense, but I didn't know I had it. But both of those senses, your proprioception and your vestibulation, are fundamental to your capacity to move. And if you lose either one, it's total paralysis And so offering stimulation to them to support movement and coordination and all of those things.
And those two are definitely being missed in sensory stories, because from my experience of sensory stories, looking around and working with lots of other people, often it's texture, it's smells, it's tastes even sometimes. Yeah. But they're all quite passive. They're still and sitting. They do lots of other activities that are moving, but I feel like maybe often it gets forgotten when it's a story. Yeah. Maybe something in our brain says, sit down for story time. It's still and it's listening and it's passive. And actually, that's not the case. And it makes so much sense from what you're saying that, of course, that's not the case.
If people are being pushed in their chairs, we all sort of wheel around in a circle and spin, and if people can move themselves, it's like a chance for a little boogie in the middle of the story. It's a good one.
Yeah, it's a great one, especially in the middle of the story, because that's when you need it.
So one of the biggest misconceptions is that somehow it is synonymous with occupational therapy, or that it's the exclusive preserve of occupational therapy, and it is not. Sensory integration as a concept, as a way of working, as a way of including people, is for everyone. Every single person should be included in sensory integration. There isn't a kind of, I'm not sensory, everybody's in. Within the formal training and formal qualifications, it is the case and has been for a long time that occupational therapists, speech and language therapists, and physiotherapists can train. So my training as an advanced practitioner in air sensory integration is exactly the same as an occupational therapist or a physiotherapist who's trained in it. I'm trained to the same level with the same things. And in fact, in these, you know, for most of the people who are training in the UK, the course they take now to train, I wrote that course, but I was the first speech and language therapist to formally train as, and that advanced level. In America, there'd been other speech therapists before, and in the UK and in Ireland, other speech therapists who were getting it, who wanted to work in a neuroaffirming way, who wanted to understand how sensory was part of what the children and adults they were supporting were doing. So there were already people doing it. That was part of my clinical work too. You know, I could see there was a missing piece, and I was lucky enough to work with an OT who was doing sensory integration, and that led me to explore more. And I was the first, as I said, the first speech and language therapist in the world to formally qualify as an advanced practitioner in AIRS SI. And I'm going to just apologize now because it's so exciting to me. I get really quick in talking.
Love it. I love it so much. I love it. It's making me so excited. Okay, let's talk about what that looks like then. What do your, so you're working with a young person. How do the two come together in that beautiful, affirming way?
Yeah, so it's the same thing. It is the same thing. So sensory integration is the framework that allows me to look at what's going on. So when we say sensory integration, what we mean is this person, this young person, this older person, they have a brain and a nervous system which has wired up to respond to the environment in specific ways. And when there's a mismatch between this young person's environment, the young person's nervous system, and the environment and the demands or the task, that's where the issue is. It's not that there's something wrong with them or wrong with their nervous system. It's they have a differently wired nervous system where when there's a mismatch, that's where the issue is. So how does that show up for speech, language and communication? If you want to be part of any kind of engagement with somebody else, you first of all need to feel safe. And second of all, you need to understand what the heck is going on. So that piece is the sensory integration piece. Feeling safe, understanding what's going on, and then being able to make use of the opportunities.
Right.
So it's what speech language therapy is. It's also what learning is.
Yeah. Regulation before communication.
Sure.
Nobody can speak their best speak, however vocal you are, if you're being chased by a tiger. And often that's how our children feel, isn't it? In those environments that aren't matched for them.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things I say a lot, Jordan, is that, you know, a really good way to think of this is that your brain is a sense-making machine. What does your brain want to do? It wants to make sense of what's happening. It will use whatever it can to make sense of what's happening. So if you feel physiologically unsafe or psychologically unsafe, your brain tells you this is not safe to be here. It is not safe to engage. You are in peril.
Yeah.
Who can save your life?
And what do you do when you're in that fight, fright or flight mode? you run, you might hit out, you might hurt yourself, you might hurt others, you might fall to the floor, you might freeze, you might hide. All of those things that are, some people might be seeing in their classrooms or in their homes with, you know, people that are in their lives, their loved ones, that might be what you're seeing. But what's happening internally is exactly that, is that survival, I don't feel safe mode, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, particularly as a parent, it's so hard when your child is kind of lashing out and there's kind of fight behaviours, because you know they're safe, and it's really hard to be in that place where you can't explain to them easily that they are safe. That actually, you know, it's kind of understanding that this is not anything you've done or not done. It's that their brain and their nervous system make sense of this environment, of this task, in a way which allows their body to go, right, what's on the plate or what's in head?
I suppose there's two different things. I'm thinking, like, there's the moment when the child is in that crisis. How you respond will be maybe very differently than when they are regulated, and what you can work on and what you can be like, and how you can, what your expectations of them, I suppose, can be very different, can't it? Would you like to talk about that a little bit, capacity in those situations?
Yeah, for sure. So that, you know, that first piece, safety first, safety first. Safety is the priority. That, you know, when you're outside and you're seeing this showing up in the classroom, in at home, in different, out in the street, out in the supermarket, once you step away from the label behavior, from the word behavior, and you look at it through the lens of, is this a child trying to feel safe, trying to make sense of what's happening? That puts you in a completely different place in relationship to what you're seeing. So the compassion and love with which you then respond is in a completely different place. So I'm not saying it's never behavior. Sometimes it is, but actually that's communication. We'll go there in a minute.
Yeah, we'll go there in a minute.
Talking about sensory peace, just that really core understanding that what you're seeing is a little brain and a little nervous system just trying to feel safe, just trying to make sense. It puts you in a place where you have so much to offer to create safety, so much to offer to create sense. That sense of, you know, that's all consuming, that sense of you cannot move past that. You can't short circuit it. You can't hurry it through. You can't decide that's enough. They're regulated now. Until they're ready, their brain is not going to be able to make use of anything else you've got to offer. So if you want a child to learn, if you want a child to thrive, if you want a child to engage, you have to invest in the relationship of making them feel safe in the moment.
What kind of things would you be looking at in that moment? And I guess it's different for every person, of course, but what kind of things would you be curious about? What would your internal monologue be saying as you're trying to work through all of these things?
That's a really good question. Of course, you know, for me, there's like a whole...
Yeah.
Here's what we ran down. So I guess, you know, for me, that first thing is kind of understanding its nervous system environment task. So the first thing I'm doing is, can we just hold off on the task, just hold off on the demand? Then I'm looking at the environment. What is there that in my knowledge of the child is making me think, actually, this could be quite challenging? And, you know, often it's things that you overlook because you feel safe in the environment. So it's, how bright are the lights? How strong are the smells? How close are people? What kind of textures do you have to deal with? What's the temperature like? All of those kind of physical aspects of the environment. And that stuff that most of the time is relatively straightforward, relatively easy to address.
That's something that I'm supporting my team with, is about that total communication approach. And actually, it's okay if Sammy goes over to the sink, gets a cup and brings you a cup. That's amazing that they're requesting a drink. But also it's okay if Sammy stands at the sink with the cup and is stuck and not sure what to do. You can then go over and prompt by using, we have like drink symbols to be removed, also a button. And I've also now recently put a talking panel that has 6 buttons on it, and it's like drink, wash hands, because it's like, you know, if they've got sticky hands from sensory play, cereal, raisins, all their like favorite snacks as well, because we do allow our children to snack throughout the day. you know, all they, I, we always want them to feel that they can request those sorts of things. And actually, it's just about that, like recognizing where you can support the children, but it's like allowing them, if they're working on creating a sentence, that's okay, but it's still okay for them just to hand you a clap. And I think sometimes some of my support staff have struggled with that because they're like, oh, but their target is to make a sentence. Yeah. And yeah. It's like, that's fine. You can extend that. You accept that form of communication, go over, help them with a drink, and then model that. I want drink, or I'm thirsty is something else we're trying. It's moving away from just like I want. So like I'm like labeling how we're feeling. I'm thirsty, I need a drink. So yeah.
Yeah, it's so true. And again, it comes down to modelling, doesn't it? And
absolutely.
Also understanding that in certain situations or on certain days, children will be able to access language and not access language. So when a pupil is dysregulated, for example, their communication abilities will reduce massively. I have a pupil that's really quick on the AAC. It's been doing it for a couple of years now. Incredibly quick. But when dysregulated, can't even make a choice of objects. Just loses all ability or want ability, I suppose, to be able to communicate in that way. He just needs us to make those decisions for him and do that for him, because he can't make choices. He can't look at photos, symbols. It is just too much.
Too overwhelming.
Yeah, and it's not that he can't. It's just that he can't right now. And I think that's also something as well, isn't it? And it might not be as big or as obvious as that with your learners. It might just be, they might be seemingly okay. And actually, just that day, they're just a bit tired. Or actually, they've been doing it all day and they just want a drink. You know, it's not an, every opportunity isn't an opportunity to stretch them. Sometimes they just want a drink. So I think that's absolutely great, is what you just said, is do the thing, give the thing, and then model what they could do.
Yeah.
We have people in our class who self-harms, and self-harms to communicate. So self-harms to get wrapped, or self-harms to get access to a chair, or gets access to a thing, or because she doesn't want it. It is communication. It would be awful for us, who, while she's punching herself in the head, to go and get her AAC, model what she wants. Give her a choice would be even worse. Yeah, but even just modelling the sentence, she's punching herself in the head. Obviously, we're not going to do that. So we see what she's doing. We give her what she needs, and then we show her a safer alternative way that she could have asked for that, you know, in the hope that, oh, that won't hurt me. Maybe I'll do that. You know, is the hope. But yeah, absolutely. Yes, of course we want her to do that. But ultimately it's about meeting their needs first, isn't it? And honouring that communication.
Absolutely. And what you just said there is something we completely honour in our class as well. And across our school, it's regulation before communication. I know we know communication is so important, and obviously behaviour is a form of communication. Whenever we have behavioural communication training across the school, we always say at the end of the day, if they are dysregulated in any way, then that the first thing to almost go is that communication, the ability to communicate effectively or in their way that they would when they're regulated, because they are no longer regulated. So you absolutely need, you take your priority is that regulation, not the teaching of communication within that moment.
Exactly. And I spoke to a speech language therapist only last week, and it was amazing how much we spoke about sensory circuit, sensory diet, sensory integration, because it's not separate. It's so interwoven into communication, so interwoven. If they aren't regulated, they cannot communicate. So of course speech and language therapists are going to spend a lot of their time regulating children so that they can communicate. It just makes sense. But listening to her and all of her, you know, methods are incredibly occupational therapy, you know, looking and sounding. And yeah, of course they are. But you know, I was taken aback by that, thinking, of course we have to do it all. We all have to do it all. Whereas I thought it was, oh, I'm a special education teacher, but I'm also this and I'm also that. And it's like, we all are. Because without one, you can't do the other, and vice versa. Yeah, so I just thought that was an interesting thing that I got out of our conversation last week was, is what you've just said is that regulation is key, isn't it, in all of
this? Absolutely, yeah. It's one of those things that it underpins everything. And I mean, we're always changing our timetable. I quite often get asked online, like, about my timetable and how my day looks. And I think
often
it's really hard to, but because we change it sometimes daily basis, or like we're like day to day, it's depending on what the children need. And at the moment, we're getting a lot of children coming in dysregulated and after their transition into school. And we just have to, we are closing the blinds. We've got our LED like calming lights on. We've got their favorite things out. And a lot of people come in and be like, oh, is this just a morning choose session? Yes, it is a morning choose session because we are regulating. Because if they come in now and I'm like, right, let's go and do some story massage and let's go and do intensive interaction, it's not going to be a positive interaction. What we need to prioritize here is getting ourselves regulated and ready to learn, because otherwise
and that's still learning.
We're not going to have a great day.
It's valuable, isn't it? I think it doesn't have to look like table or paperwork. That's something that special education teachers do really well, actually, that learning can be in the corridor, learning can be outside of the field, learning can be on choosing time. In fact, that we get the best communication at choosing time and golden time, or whatever you want to call it. There are some of our best moments in the toilet, like it's some of our best learning and most important learning moments for independence, just because it isn't called English or maths or communication or problem solving, whatever you want to call it. Doesn't mean that there's not learning happening, because actually some of the most important lessons for our learners happen around those subject areas. The subject areas are kind of the fluff. And actually it's about care needs, it's about teaching independence, about teaching communication, teaching about to advocate for their sensory needs and regulation. You know, it's all of those things. It has to be. And we're constantly saying we meet care needs first and then we learn. And sometimes some weeks we've just met their care needs, actually, and that is okay, because that, I mean, we have the luxury of that. I feel like all teachers could, though. But I feel like we're almost granted the luxury of that. That is just accepted that of course you do. But it's interesting to me that all teachers are SEND teachers these days. And and it's almost, if you're listening to this and you're a mainstream teacher, just know that you're a SEND teacher too, and you also have the ability, and you know, should feel like you have the ability to support your learners in that way. That if, you know, neurodivergent, disabled or not, if a pupil comes in and they're not ready to learn for whatever reason, something might have happened in the morning, they might not have had a good sleep, they might be feeling unwell, they might have fallen out with a friend, they might not have got picked for the football team, whatever it is, they might not also be ready to learn. And it's almost like trusting your instincts there and navigating the class how they are. I see it, I'm attached to a mainstream school, so I do see it. Say, for example, if we've had a sports event and something really exciting has happened in the morning, you can see the teachers like, well, you know, that's this afternoon gone, because we need to change. Or if it's wet play even, you can say,
oh yeah,
we need to do something else. So I definitely see it in my school, and I really hope that other schools feel like they can do that. Because if you want the children to remember what you've taught them, they're going to have to be regulated, aren't they?
Thinking back to your child that you were just talking about that was distressed and couldn't have words, well, surely communication and regulation are the start of improving mental health. Surely.
Yeah, I think it's got to be it. And I think it's then almost again taking that step back as to, okay, so what's the lens through which we're viewing these difficulties, and how do we then kind of support that communication and regulation? And I think that is then part of the bigger conversation around behavior support and the narrative through which we view the way that some of these children show up at times. I recently did an inset day training at school. I was talking to them about how, you know, Ross Green's work, particularly around ADHD children, but I think it is for all children, in my view, that kids do well when they can. And I think for me, that is so powerful, because if a child is not doing well, you know, firstly, whose expectation is what is well? And that's a question in itself. But then if they're not, like, we need to look at what's going on around them, right? And thinking about their internal state, those basic needs, are they met? Can they communicate that? Do they feel safe and secure? Do they feel, you know, are they fed? Are they watered? Like, have they had a good rest? Do they need the toilet? Do they know if they need the toilet? You know, are they uncomfortable? Exactly. And I think we then kind of look at that, and then the next piece around them becomes that, okay, so how do we work out what's going on and then teach them the ways to regulate that and communicate that. And also thinking about, for me, part of that is the environment and that inclusive communication environment that's going on. But I also think sometimes the activities, you know, like I see some kids who perhaps are presenting as not doing so well and that kind of challenging time. But I think, is that because the activity is too hard or not hard enough and therefore they're a bit disinterested and creating their own entertainment?
Or too overstimulating.
For me, part of that is also recognising that fluctuating capacity of neurodivergent kids, right? Because they might be able to do something one day that they can't do the next day, or even in the morning that they can't do in the afternoon. And that, for a lot of people, can be quite baffling. But if we take an affirming approach and an honouring approach, it is about believing kids, tuning in and getting to know them and getting to know when are those times to perhaps push and perhaps kind of encourage a bit more, and when are the times to just go, that's cool, I can see you're done, we need to focus on that regulation piece, let's bring your energy back in line, whether it's too low, too high, to get you in a better place, and then we'll see what's next, you know. And I think for me, so much of that affirming practice around communication starts at that level, you know, starts at taking a step back and just seeing what's going on and believing kids. You know, there's so much power in validation around just listening, isn't there? And I think that's the case for any kind of level of learner and support needs. You know, I could work with some really high support needs kids, and they might be, you know, communicating through self-injurious behavior, their frustration, and just being able to validate and say, it's really frustrating. You know, I think there's sometimes this view in our minds that actually children don't have capacity for language and don't have capacity for understanding because of their lack of expressive language. And yeah, they might not in that moment, but we can teach it, and we have to believe that they have capacity to understand it. So that kind of validation and giving, my supervisor, Kate Boot, talks about language for experience. And I think that's it. It's like actually in those moments, giving some language to the experience that they're having and honouring how they're showing up, and then thinking about that step back and what do we need to do next time to support communication and regulation in those situations.
So would it look like naming maybe what they're expressing? So I can see you're frustrated that you can't do this. Like, is that what it sounds like?
Yeah, I mean, for me, sometimes it sounds like that. There is challenge, isn't there, in trying to name emotions for somebody
because
else?
How do you know? Yeah, so how do you navigate that?
Usually what I find myself saying is like, this seems tough, or it's hard.
I like that.
Some things I can see, this is tricky. I sometimes will, on an ASC device, like we use quite a lot of Grid and Smartbox, but anything, they've got one on their messages that's just something's wrong. And so I might just model that, like, I think, and say something's wrong.
Yeah, because that's not putting on to them what they're feeling. It's just, I can see something's wrong.
Yeah.
That is clear. Yeah. And it's just, that's still validating, isn't it? That I can see something's wrong, i.e. can I help in any way?
And sometimes I would just say, like, I'm here.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I do that on a device. I do that with my language. I do that with my body language, you know, and just be like, I'm here and I'm going to, you know, you're safe. Like, it will be okay.
Yeah.
But so you can give, like, language, I think, that kind of validates the experience and links in with their experiences, but also can kind of reassuring, nurturing in those moments. But generally, like, again, that's a practice years ago. I've been like, we label the emotions and like show them the symbol, and now I'm like, okay,
no, that makes so much sense to me. I've always struggled with how to say it, so that makes so much sense. And I feel like maybe the more we do that, it then becomes easier to find that language, to find that script that isn't putting on them what they may not be feeling, and yet still showing them that you've shown up for them.
Yeah. And I think, like, so often, you know, the difference between anxiety and frustration, like, how do we know that their frustration is not driven by anxiety? And so I think, you know, and some of these kids, they don't necessarily have the skills at this point in time to talk about what it was, but there is sort of comfort in validation.
Yeah.
And one of the things I talk a lot to staff about is our natural reaction to say, it's okay. And actually what I'm trying to get people to say, it's not okay.
Yeah.
Because again, that's language of their experience that they're having. So I think we can say, like, I can see it's not okay. You know, I can see it's tricky. Like, I'm here. You're safe. It will be okay. You know, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And again, you know the children you're working with to tune in and know how much language is too much.
I mean, that's the point as well, isn't it? That if you've got a good relationship and a trusting relationship with this child already, which is what I would, like, it has to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
then they will also know that you mean best as well. So even if you get it wrong or you're too close or whatever, yeah. if you've got that trusting relationship, there's a little bit more leniency there, a little bit that you can kind of work it through together. Whereas if you come in and you haven't got those trusting relationships, you haven't built that connection yet, it's going to be really tricky. And even if you are saying the right things and doing the right things, it's going to be really hard for them to trust that you in that moment when they're completely in fight or flight mode.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's so important that when in just taking every opportunity to build those connections, and that looks like being led by them, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And validating and, you know, sort of sharing their joy and also being there when it's not so joyful.
That's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed taking a look back at some of my favorite moments from series one. If you would like to be on my podcast for series two, then please get in touch. You can email me at oursensorykids@gmail.com or just send me a DM on social media, and I'd love to have you on. See you next time.